Welcome to Builders, a podcast from BetaWorks Studios featuring the amazing people who build things, the makers and the doers, not just the talkers, the people who are helping shape this world and the next world we'll live in. My name is Layla Ueda, and I'll be your guide. Be sure to subscribe to Builders in iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. We release new episodes every Tuesday. All these episodes are recorded live at Studios, our New York City clubhouse for builders and anyone else interested in the startup ecosystem. Each week, they feature a new and diverse mix of people drawn from our community. Only at BetaWorks Studios will you find founders and the network around founders authentically chatting about subjects that really matter. If you want to know more about our club, just visit betaworks-studios.com anytime or contact me for a day pass. But listening to these podcasts is a pretty good reflection of life here. One week, we might be talking about how to design for blockchain or build experiences in the age of Instagram. And the following week, we're chatting with technology luminaries like Jaron Lanier on why we should probably all delete our social media accounts. Today's episode features Andrew Yang, a former VC who's now running for president in 2020. Andrew came by BetaWorks Studios to tell his story and platform. I won't give away the game too much, but his basic platform revolves around the idea that AI and machine learning are going to decimate U.S. employment more than they already have, and that the only real way to solve this issue is through universal basic income. Although Andrew doesn't call it that, he has a much better name for it, so take a listen and you'll find out. He'll also talk about how Trump won and how he sees his path to victory. Andrew's interviewed by BetaWorks Studios head of programming, Ben Scheim. All right, enjoy this episode.
Hello all, I'm Andrew Yang, running for president as a Democrat in 2020. How many of you know about Venture for America? Paul, oh my gosh, almost everyone, that's very exciting. So I'm an entrepreneur who traveled the country for the last 7 years, helping create a few thousand jobs. And I did this after I was CEO of an education company that was acquired by a public company. And that company helped people get into fancy business schools. It's called Manhattan Prep. I personally taught the analyst classes at Goldman Sachs, McKinsey, JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley. And I saw all these, frankly, really unhappy, smart young people who hated their jobs and were like, oh, I'm going to go to business school and hit the reset button and take $100K out in school loans. And I was like, oh, what a disaster. And then when my company was acquired in 2009, I made a list of the biggest problems I saw. And the biggest problem at the time, to me, was that we had so much talent and energy heading towards activities that were not meaningfully going to move our society or economy forward. And it wasn't even making the people happy, just like turning them into sad people. And I could relate to that because I was a sad corporate attorney for 5 months in the late 90s and early 2000s. I went to Brown, didn't know what to do, so I went to Columbia for law school, didn't know what to do, so I became an M&A and banking attorney, which was the shittiest job of all time. And was there for 5 months being like, this is terrible. and it's like, this is really what we're doing? Like, this is like a temple to the squandering of human potential, this law firm. I think that was like my quote at the time. Like over beers, I was like, this place is like a temple to the squandering of human potential. Like, I was like, I don't know what you mean. It's great. So I left to start a .com, which you guys can relate to. How many of you all are starting a company? Working in tech? So I started a .com that flamed out, and then I worked at another startup, and then I became head of this education company. So I've been an entrepreneur and startup guy for a couple decades now. And so when I started Venture for America, I donated $120,000 of my own to seed the organization, started calling rich friends saying, do you love America? And then they said, what does it mean if I say yes? And then I said, at least $10,000. And like 12 of them said, I love America for $10,000. And I said, great. So we started with a budget of a couple $100,000 and then grew and grew. And this year our budget's between 6 and 7 million, thousands of jobs, hundreds of alums like Paul here. Paul's a VFA or 2014, spent 2 years in St. Louis. There's a movie made about us that's now on Netflix. If you guys like documentaries about, oh my gosh, you guys would really like documentary about entrepreneurs. It's called Generation Startup. Oscar-winning director follow 6 entrepreneurs around for a year and a half while they try and build businesses. It's called Generation Startup. I make cameos as the magical Asian man who helps young people. So that's what I did for the last 7 years. How many of you are from the New York metro area like me? West Coast? Midwest, South, there's a very, very New York-centered crowd here. Not shocking, it's cool. Me too, I was born in Schenectady and then grew up in Westchester County. My father is a physicist who generated 69 US patents for GE and IBM. And then I went to Exeter for high school, same place Philip went, then Brown, Columbia. So you got a sense of my you know, nerdiness. So I'm from the same background that you guys are from, give or take. And so I had never been to Detroit, Cleveland, St. Louis, Birmingham, New Orleans before starting Venture of America. I had this vision. I was like, you know, we got smart people like Paul to head to places like St. Louis, create businesses instead of becoming toolbox SAD management consultants. That would be a massive, massive win. And what I did not realize until I got out there was just how beleaguered many other parts of the country are. Where a woman in Ohio said to me that in Ohio, change is a four-letter word. And I didn't know what she meant, because it's not. You can count them. But then I spent some time with her, and she explained to me that in Northeast Ohio, change meant a business closing or someone leaving, where the vision of success is to leave that place. And so that ends up creating a negative attitude around progress. And so I was learning all of this between 2011 and last year, but I was still stunned when Donald Trump won the election in 2016, which you all remember. You're probably here in New York. And I absorbed this and was like, okay, what just happened? We just elected a narcissist reality star. This is an emblem to the accelerating decline of civilization. And so I started looking into the numbers, and there's a very, very clear, direct correlation between the adoption of industrial robots in a voting area and the movement towards Donald Trump. The reason why Donald Trump is our president today is very, very straightforward. It's that we automated away 4 million manufacturing jobs that were centered in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, Missouri, Iowa, all of the states that Trump needed to win and did win. If you work in tech, you know that what we did to the manufacturing workers, we're about to do to the retail workers, the call center workers, the fast food workers, the truck drivers, and on and on. And those are, unfortunately, the most common jobs in the U.S. economy. So, again, most common jobs in the U.S. economy, administrative and clerical work is number one, retail is number two, food service and food prep is number three, truck driving and transportation is number four, and manufacturing is number five. What proportion of American workers do you think work in one of those five categories? A third, 50%. 50% is right, it's 49%. What percentage of Americans graduate from college? 32%. So when you're talking about the average American worker, you're talking about a high school graduate or someone with 1 year of college. So if you think about the average job, it's one of these five jobs that's filled by a high school graduate. The average pay in these jobs is about $15 an hour. Now, if you look at them, you can see, if you work in technology, how many of you saw the demo of Google AI outperforming or like making appointments for people? Like, you all saw that, right? Now, what do we all think the time frame is on AI being able to outperform a call center worker who makes $14 an hour? 2 years, 3 years. Yeah, 2 to 3 years, maybe less, because that job's not that great. You know, how many of us have gotten frustrated with a human in the last year? So there are 2.5 million call center workers in the United States right now that make $14 an hour. So when AI can outperform them, how many jobs is that going to mean? It's not going to mean 1,000 jobs or 5,000 jobs. That could mean hundreds of thousands of jobs. Number two is retail. How many of you have noticed stores closing around where you live? And we live in really nice places for the most part. 30% of malls are going to close in the next 4 years, virtually guaranteed. And being a retail clerk and cashier is the most common job in this country. There are about 9 million cashiers. The average retail worker is a 39-year-old woman who's a high school graduate who makes between $11 and $12 an hour. Now, what is that population, what's their next move going to be when the stores close and the malls close? That's a rhetorical question, because like no one knows. Now, the one that scares the shit out of me is truck drivers. Truck driving is the most common job in 29 states in this country. There are 3.5 million truckers, average age 49, 94% male. So when you think about a truck driver, that's actually a truck driver. There's no like other profile. It's like, actually, truck drivers are no, that's a truck driver. It's like, it's a 49-year-old man with a high school degree, the most common job in 29 states. They make $46,000 a year. It's actually one of the more highly paid jobs for a high school grad. And they're one of the few professions or jobs that does not do background checks and does not do drug tests. So they have massive labor shortage, and so they're just trying to get you in. Like, if you come out of the military or jail, like, being a trucker is one of the jobs that's actually available to you. Now, how many of you have friends who are working on autonomous vehicles on the West Coast? I do. What do we think the time frame is on self-driving trucks hitting highways? 3 years. 3 years. 5 years. So I've talked to people in Silicon Valley. They tell me that they are 98% of the way there. The last 2% is quite stubborn, but they're very confident that they're going to get there because their economic incentives are $168 billion per year in cost savings, fuel efficiency, fewer accidents, equipment utilization. It's one of the biggest pots of gold in American business. So let's say it's 5 to 10 years. And the first vision is going to be there's going to be a human-driven truck, first truck, and then a robot truck following it, like less wind resistance, better fuel efficiency, the human can make the decisions. They're also equipping trucks to have teleoperating capacity, where if the truck's not sure what to do because of the weather is bad, like tonight, then a teleoperator can beam in from a warehouse in Nevada or Arizona and just take over. And then the computer will then say, okay, I've got it from here, and then they'll beam out. So what do you think the ratio is going to be between teleoperators and this 3.5 million truck driver population? Yeah, like 40 to 1, maybe a couple percent. And what is the next economic option going to be for this truck driving population? They make $46,000 now. What are they going to make in 5 to 10 years when the trucks start driving themselves? Again, rhetorical, like no one knows. I mean, you might think Walmart greeter, but Walmart's not going to be hiring greeters. You know what I mean? Like this is the hard reality of what's happening in this country. So we're in the middle of the biggest economic and technological transformation in the history of the world. And the third inning has brought us Donald fucking Trump. Like, reflect on that for a moment. We got rid of 4 million manufacturing workers. We got rid of 5 million, but 4 million were due to technology. How many of you studied economics in college? Some of you. So according to our economics textbooks, what happens to 4 million manufacturing workers who lose their jobs? So my economics textbook said that they'd be retrained, reskilled, find new jobs at a higher productivity, the economy grows, all is well, right? Do you guys remember that chapter? So then I went and researched what actually happened, the displaced manufacturing workers of the Midwest. And it did not work out like the textbook said. About half of them left the workforce and never worked again. And of the half that left the workforce and never worked again, about half of them filed for disability. There are now more Americans on disability than work in construction. 20% of working age adults in some parts of the country are on disability. And so what you saw is you saw this surge in disability and then an equivalent surge in suicides and drug use, where now our life expectancy has declined for the last 2 years because of a spike in suicides and the fact that 8 Americans are dying of opiates every hour. So you did not, that was also not in my economics textbook. It was not like, oh, they're going to go home and kill themselves. It was like they're going to go home and get retrained and whatnot. Now, I also looked into the effectiveness rate of retraining programs. Because when I talked to politicians about this, they said three things to me. They said, we can't talk about that. We should study that further. And the third one that almost sounds reasonable is we must retrain and re-educate Americans for the jobs of the future. So I then said, okay, I'm kind of a geek, so I looked up the studies. Do you all want to guess how effective government-funded retraining programs are on a percentage basis? Paul says 10. 15, 5. No one ever guesses 85. No one ever is like, we're going to be great at this. We're going to retrain the shit out of people. No, we're not going to retrain the shit out of people. It turns out the effectiveness rate is between 0 and 15%, and fewer than 10% of Americans qualify anyway. It's not like when a mall closes, there's an army of government retrainers like, we're here to retrain you to like do some other job that no one knows what it is. So it's a fantasy. It's like a make-believe talking point. It might solve 2% of the problem, you know, if we got really good at it. So this is all of the stuff that was coming down on me like a ton of bricks in 2017. Like, I'm a fact-based, rational human, and I had to go around being like, hey guys, like, what's the plan? What's the plan? And everyone's like, there's no plan. Like, you know, market magic, invisible hand, industrial revolution. And I was like, are you shitting me? Like, that's the response to this? Like, you do realize the industrial revolution involved mass violence and protests that killed dozens of people and caused billions of dollars worth of damage. It involved the origination of labor unions. It involved the inauguration of Labor Day in response to riots. It involved implementing universal high school in 1911. And according to Bain, this time is going to be 3 to 4 times faster and more vicious in terms of job displacement than the Industrial Revolution. So the people who are all like, it'll be okay, Industrial Revolution, like, aren't even paying attention to the facts either then or now. And what infuriated me the most is that some of these people were like VCs who are like Industrial Revolution. And I was like, if some entrepreneur came into your office and started citing like 120-year-old fact patterns, you'd like laugh them out of your office. You'd be like, well, according to the horse and buggy market of 1900, like this app should really work. You know, it's like that's ridiculous. But that's actually the logic that people were busting out in response. It's like, it was just so weird. And so I became convinced, I was like, oh my gosh, like we really are just on like a freight train. It's just like heading towards this really disastrous future. Again, this all came down on me in 2017. So then, as an entrepreneur, like all of you, I started trying to figure out what are solutions, what are meaningful, real solutions that one could implement if one believes that we are going through the greatest economic and technological transformation in the history of the world. And it's a very, very short list of things you could do. Now, I was introduced saying that I'm for universal basic income, which I am. And universal basic income is one of the only things we can plausibly do that would help society manage this transition. So my plan is the Freedom Dividend, which I named because it tests much better with more Americans than universal basic income. Universal basic income tests well with about half of Americans, the progressive half, honestly. The conservatives hate it. But then when you have the word freedom in it, all of a sudden it tests great with conservatives, and progressives like it the same. Progressives just like it no matter what you call it, it turns out. So the Freedom Dividend is a plan where everyone who's an adult in America gets $1,000 a month, free and clear, no questions asked. And what that would mean in real life for families, right now 57% of Americans cannot afford an unexpected $500 bill. So what are they going to do with $1,000 a month? They're going to spend it on paying their bills, on repairing their car, on supplies and tutoring for their kids, on better food. And so the money's just going to go straight into Main Street economy, and it's going to end up growing the consumer economy by about 12% and creating about 4 million new jobs because the garage has to hire another mechanic, the restaurant has to hire another server, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's like you're just supercharging a Main Street economy that's going to create accessible opportunities near people, near where people are, instead of having more and more value just get sucked out of more and more of these towns. So that's the big move, is the Freedom Dividend. The second big move is getting healthcare off the backs of families and businesses, because it doesn't make sense to tie healthcare to jobs if jobs are going to disappear. And right now, 94% of the new jobs created in this country since 2005 have been temporary gig or contractor jobs that don't have healthcare benefits. So we need to start owning that the old employment-based model does not make sense and get healthcare off the backs of businesses and families. As an entrepreneur, it's much better for business if we don't have to worry about healthcare. Like, how many of you have hesitated to switch jobs or hire someone or start something because of healthcare concerns or costs? I have. And so we can get that off of your backs, then you can make better decisions around the jobs you take, the people you hire. Right now, it's a huge disincentive to hire if you have to pay for people's healthcare. I mean, it's very unfortunate, but it's true as a CEO. And the third thing, and this is a question that Philip asked me beforehand, is that we have to start changing how we measure economic progress and value in this society. So the example I like to use is that my wife is home right now with our two boys, one of whom is autistic. How much does her work contribute to GDP? Nothing. GDP says that's a zero. How many of you wake up thinking, I'm going to contribute to GDP today? Like, you know, nobody, unless you're crazy. Some of you might be crazy. So we have to start translating economic value into things that would actually indicate how we're doing. And things that more people can, frankly, help with. So what might those measurements look like to a room of entrepreneurs and innovators like yourselves? Like, how would you measure economic progress and growth? Philip, I know you got some ideas. Life satisfaction. I like it. You had a thought in the back, miss? Yeah, learning. Education levels, childhood success rates, quality-adjusted life expectancy and health. So you'd see that our life expectancy is actually getting shorter, which is crazy if you think about it. And it's unique to America. Like, only we are dying sooner as a developed country. There's a thought over here. Mental health and freedom from stress and substance abuse. And then again, you'd see that we have a massive mental health crisis in this country. We have a massive substance abuse crisis. They're all of the hallmarks of a sick society right now. We start fewer businesses. We move across state lines at lower levels than we have in decades. And that's depressing. We get married less. We have kids at lower levels. All of these things are either at multi-decade lows or record lows. I mean, this economy, And like GDP is this phantom measurement that just keeps on going up. And we're all supposed to be like, oh, well, that's good. But even the inventor of GDP during the Great Depression, Simon Kuznets, said this is a terrible measurement for national well-being and we should not use it as that. He also said we should include parenthood and motherhood in the measurement and we should not include national defense spending because it has no value. So of course we ignored all those things and now like we're going to ride GDP off a cliff. So we need to upgrade our economic measuring stick. Right now we're in the midst of the greatest measurement problem in the history of the world and it's going to destroy us. So if we create better measurements, then it can free up people like you to do so many awesome things that actually move society forward in more human ways. If you make people stronger, healthier, smarter, stronger, more mindful, any of those things, you can actually realize economic value. So that is the master plan to save us from what's happening in our economy. And I'm going to close by saying that Donald Trump won in 2016, and what the country needs is the opposite of Donald Trump. And the opposite of Donald Trump is an Asian man who likes math. So thank you very much. We'll be very excited to take some questions later.
All right. I want to start. There were a bunch of things that you got into there. I want to start just by outlining the tenets of universal basic income again, and especially bringing up some of the major criticisms that you can read on countless articles, countless coffee shop conversations. A couple of the things, and I just would love to get your response to these. So, first thing, obviously, that lots of people say is, how do you pay for it? It would be financially irresponsible. Ballooning deficits, higher taxes would be required. How do you respond to that criticism and that question, frankly? How do you pay for it?
Yeah. So the trap that we're in right now is that I'm going to ask you all, who are going to be the big winners from AI, big data, self-driving cars and trucks, all coming online?
Yes.
The big winners, Google, VCs, Facebook, tech companies. It's going to tend to be the biggest tech companies because right now they have trillion-dollar valuations they can throw around. If there's some promising AI company, they can like throw down $5 to $10 billion, snap it up, absorb it. And so the trap we're in right now is that the companies that are going to realize the most value in this era are not really going to pay a lot of taxes on that value because Google just says it all went through Ireland, nothing to see here. Amazon says didn't make any money this quarter, like no taxes necessary, even though Jeff Bezos is now the richest man alive and they're worth $1 trillion. And so that is the trap, where we're going to look around and say, like, okay, these companies are sucking up more and more work and value, and then we can't pay for anything. So the big move we have to make is we have to join every other industrialized country in the world and have a value-added tax, which would then get the public a sliver of every Amazon transaction, every Google search. Because our economy is now so vast at $19 trillion, up $4 trillion in the last 10 years, a value-added tax at even half the European level would generate about $800 billion in new revenue. That, combined with the $800 billion we currently spend on welfare programs, 126 of them, plus the economic growth from growing the consumer economy by 12%, plus the cost savings and the value gains from spending less on incarceration, homelessness services, emergency room healthcare, and having a stronger, more educated, more mentally stable, more entrepreneurial society, altogether you can pay for a universal basic income of $1,000 a month and have it be deficit neutral. But I would suggest that in this milieu, like the trap we're in more globally is that the enemy of universal basic income is, as a neuroscientist said to me, the human mind. And what he meant by that is that we are programmed for resource scarcity and saying like, oh, if we do this, then you know it's going to crash the economy, not enough money to go around, et cetera, et cetera. And the opposite of this mindset of scarcity is truly this mindset of abundance, where we say we're the richest, most advanced country in the history of the world. We can easily afford $1,000 per adult. It will pay for itself many times over. And if you're a good company, you're always saying we're going to invest in our people. But in a public space, we think everyone's a cost. We have to avoid spending money on them. It's like, if I can just avoid spending money on that kid, avoid spending money on those people, then all will be well. And that's the opposite of the tack we need to take. We need to start investing in people and know, and especially in this case, because the people are us. You know, we have to invest in ourselves, start believing in ourselves.
Great. So next question is, some people say that, you know, by switching from a targeted to generalized support system, that the people that need care most would actually get less, and people who don't need anything would end up getting something. So it would lead to higher inequality and poverty.
Yeah, so I know that many people rely upon programs for their day-to-day and monthly survival. And I know that some of them are getting significantly more than $1,000 a month. And I have zero desire to pull a rug out from anyone. So the plan is to make the Freedom Dividend opt in. And only if you opt into it do you lose your current benefits. But if you look around and say, I like my current benefits just fine, then just don't opt in and we'll leave you alone. So I do think that there is like a strain of hyper-libertarian where it's like, we're going to gut it all and then just like replace it with cash. That I think is stupid, frankly. Because like if someone's on disability and like getting $1,600 a month on disability, you can't just replace that with $1,000 and be like, oh, this will be better. Like, that doesn't make any sense. But you know, you do have to also acknowledge, though, that many of our programs right now have really destructive and perverse incentives attached to them, where there's a friend of mine whose sister was afraid to volunteer at a nonprofit because she's on disability, and she's afraid if she volunteers, they're going to identify her as being able-bodied and take her benefits away. And that's normal. They're like millions of Americans who essentially become shut-ins from society because they're afraid of being of losing their disability benefits, to the point where right now the churn rate from long-term disability in the United States is literally 0%. Like no one ever feels better. So that stuff is really perverse and messed up, and that can be improved on dramatically.
Yeah, so that I think the opt-in point is one that distinguishes your UBI versus a lot of other people's, as you said, the more hardcore libertarian argument. So another idea is that UBI would undermine individual accountability and societal participation. Essentially, the Fordian idea that work and individual pride in earning income is what holds society together, what gives us a sense of meaning, and we would experience societal decay if people have less motivation to participate in society and a lifetime of dependence and unemployment.
Yeah, so here's the thing we have to, everyone like, you know, misconstrues about universal basic income, is that it's very, very pro-work in the sense that no one, virtually no one, is going to quit their job on $1,000 a month. I mean, even if you're a server at a restaurant making $24,000 a year, if I say, hey, good news, you're getting $1,000 a month, are they going to quit their job tomorrow? I mean, that would mean a 50% pay cut, and they're barely making ends meet now. Where if they keep that job, maybe cut back on one shift, they make $32,000, and then they might be able to save a little bit. They might be able to take their kid out for a movie once a week. Like, you know, like things would just get marginally better. But it's certainly not meant to be a work replacement. And no one in this country can live and prosper on $1,000 a month. Now, the reverse is also true, where, like, how many people would feel more secure to start something or change jobs or move for a new opportunity if they had $1,000 that was portable? A lot of people. Like, you know, we could make this market, this labor market, much, much more dynamic and efficient by freeing people up, because there are millions of Americans right now who are stuck in place. And people who think it's going to somehow weaken society just aren't like, they don't see the mechanics. Because if you think about it, like, as the most basic example, give $1,000 a month to, like, everyone in a town in Missouri with 5,000 people, it's like an extra $60 million in that town. Is the church in that town going to see an increase in donations? Yeah, it's going to be immense. Like right now that church is dying, and then all of a sudden everyone like gets an extra $1,000 a month. That church is probably going to see like a massive budgetary increase. So is every nonprofit in that town. Like you're actually going to supercharge all of these civic institutions and religious institutions. Like everyone's actually going to have some more money to spend instead of just dwindling to nothingness. So if people who think this is somehow going to decay society, like really just have it backwards.
Yeah, and so I think one of the things that is interesting to think about, too, is that you're proposing that everyone, no matter whether or not you live in an expensive city like New York or San Francisco or in upstate New York, that you would still get the same flat rate of $1,000.
Yeah, you can't be policing where people live, you know, like and be like, oh, it's like if you live in New York, it's $1,200. You live in Connecticut, it's like you know, like there'd be a million ways to game it. And what you want to do is you want to try and make it so that there are incentives to go in both directions. So how many people in New York feel stuck here and be like, well, you know, I could actually use like a year in a cabin to work on my great American novel or whatever it is. And then there are people who are in rural areas who'd be like, well, with $1,000 a month, maybe I'll give the city a shot. Like we just need to get people moving in both directions instead of people, again, feeling stuck in one or the other.
Yeah, so to me, that's a great talking point for UBI, is that it's actually a potential opportunity to inject growth outside of cities where we're experiencing massive losses of growth. I'm from a small town in upstate New York called Oneonta, and it's the population in that county has decreased every decade for the last 60 years.
Yeah, and it's like that in 80% of the country, truly. I mean, that's one of the revelations of my traveling the country. It's like you go to most of the country, and it's like Oneonta, and it's shrinking, and then everyone's bullshitting about the future prospects, and then we act like, oh, we can just get internet to Oneonta, then it'll all like heal itself. Like if you have internet,
you just like, further reinforce the points of young people that there are things out there that they can find out about and that they should leave. Basically, is what ends up happening with the internet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like we treat it like internet access is going to make everyone an entrepreneur, and it's garbage. It's like it's just going to mean they can download videos faster.
So that connects to a point that I've really been interested in is why are you running as a Democrat? Because there's a strong argument, I think, that actually it's all those areas, the 80% of the country that you're talking about, that are actually traditional Republican strongholds. Why is it that you think that you've chosen to run it as a Democrat rather than an independent or some other platform?
You know, most of these places were not traditional Republican strongholds until quite recently, and it's because the Democratic Party has lost its way and like started swimming in like a set of issues aside from economic empowerment of the working class, which is the majority of the country. So, but I would consider myself an independent by nature. Like someone called universal basic income.
Are you a Bernie Sanders Democrat then?
You know, I'm like a problem-solving type. I mean, 44% of Americans identify as independents. I honestly am probably in that 44% more than I am in the 28% that identifies as Democrats. But I'm also a problem solver and entrepreneur, and running as an independent is a path to nowhere. Whereas if you have a crowded Democratic field of 30 candidates, which we will have, then you can actually make a lot of headway. So I'm going to share this all with you, too. Like some of you are thinking, like, wow, this guy is pretty interesting, but he has no shot at actually being president. Some of you are thinking that. It's cool. Now, you go into our political system, and you realize that it is a total mess, where it has like these massive pipes that are clogged with money and all these like toolboxy institutionalized people like guarding the money, and it's a disaster. But like every other system, it has vulnerabilities, and it has pressure points, and it has like high leverage variables. And so if you examine the pipes, you find a porthole, and then you crawl through the porthole, and you wind up in Iowa. Now, Iowa is a state of 3.1 million Americans. Guess how many Iowans participated in the Democratic caucus in 2016 on a percentage basis?
31.
5.6%. So 170,000 Iowans participated. So let's say that goes up. Now, there are a few reasons for this. The main reason is that caucusing is a very, very high commitment activity. It is not you go in, you get an anonymous ballot, you like pull the lever, you get a sticker, you walk out feeling good about yourself, you like post a selfie. It's not like that. It's you go into this hall, and then you publicly have to say, I'm for Andrew Yang, because he's the only one talking about real solutions, and you have to argue with your neighbors and do it publicly, and then reorganize several times because some people aren't viable. And the whole process takes a couple of hours. So who wants to drive to their local union hall in the dead of winter in Iowa and argue with their neighbors for 2 hours? 170,000 people, that's who. So let's say the number goes up to 200,000 in 2020. 200,000 Iowans, Democratic caucus 2020, 30 Democratic candidates. How many of them do I need to win? So, yeah, the loudest voices, that's true, man. The most passionate people. I need to win, let's say, give or take, 25 to 30,000 Iowans to win the whole thing. Because in a crowded field that's going to eat up a lot of that vote, if you end up with even something like 15%, you might finish first. Like there are people who've won Iowa traditionally with like 25%, but that's in a field of like 10. So if you have a field of 30, you need approximately 15% to win. So I've been to Iowa 6 times. I'm going back in December to headline an event called Progress Iowa, and the Iowans love me. And there is a video of me speaking to 1,000 Iowans on YouTube right now. And they love me because I'm the only one who just says to them flat out, have you noticed stores closing where you live? And they're like, yes. And it's like, why is that, Amazon? Is that going to get better or worse? Much, much worse. So what are you going to do about it? Like, what can we do about it? We just live in Iowa. It's like, that's wrong. You can make me the president. I will return $1,000 from that value that's just getting sucked up to Seattle, give it back to you, let you rebuild your Main Street economies, and give your kids a reason to stay. And is that convincing to 15% of Iowans, like including the most Democratic hardcore activists? Hell yes, it is. Bernie Sanders won. He tied for first in Iowa, and all of his supporters are now looking around for the next Bernie. And they have said to me, like, I love Bernie, I fought for Bernie, I organized for Bernie, but I do not want Bernie to run again because we need someone who's going to actually be here for the long haul. In parentheses, he's too old and he's going to die. And you are the younger, more tech-savvy, more Asian version of Bernie, and you are my guy. I've gotten that dozens of times. There's a kid who's dropping out of Harvard Law this week to move to Iowa for my campaign because he saw the same thing I saw. So there is a real opportunity for me to just get that 30,000 Iowans base energized. Like, you know, the University of Iowa, like in Iowa City, has almost that number just hanging out. Like, you think I can get a bunch of college kids to vote for $1,000 a month for themselves? You know, so I can win. I can win Iowa. The headlines January 2020 are the Asian man who wants to give everyone money just won Iowa. I'm front page news. And then we go from there to New Hampshire, where libertarians are like a third party. And libertarians love universal basic income. And it's an open primary, and they're allowed to participate in either one. The Republican primary is going to be Donald Trump crushing Jeff Flake. No one's going to care. But then you're going to have this super crowded Democratic primary, and then the guy that libertarians love running. I have a real path to victory. So as an entrepreneur and operator, I did not know all of this before starting to operate. Like, it took me 6 months to figure out what I just shared with you all. But now that I see it, I have a real path to victory. Like, we can actually, this is not an abstract conversation about like, oh, wouldn't it be nice if people got universal basic income? This is a fight for the survival of this country. If there is not someone like me who actually implements policies like this in the next reasonable time frame, we're going to disintegrate.
That's pretty weighty, and I would agree that you are definitely the more Asian Bernie Sanders of the two of you. So a couple more questions. If you had to choose right now, either you in 1 year, the United States will actually adopt a universal basic income, or you become president of the United States in 2020, what would you choose?
Oh, no brainer, universal basic income, man. I don't really care about like my own like political, you know, future. You know, I'm just trying to solve the problem so my kids don't wake up to the spectacle of violent truckers, you know? And then eventually it won't be like just videos on their screen. Yeah. It'll be like, you know, like the fact that we can't go anywhere. So I mean, this is all coming to, you know, first a screen near us, but then like a community near us. So I do not care about my own political prospects. I'm just running to solve the problem. And if another politician wakes up one morning and is like, Andrew Yang's a fucking genius and we're going to do everything he said, and then becomes president, like, no one's going to be happier than me.
Excellent. All right. So let's open it up to some questions from the audience right there.
Yeah, so this is completely like not at all data driven. So forgive me for my ignorance, Andrew. Obviously, I assume that you've like done some kind of polling or collected some kind of data on this because that's the kind of guy you are. But when you say that, you know, this freedom dividend will like dominantly inject value into Main Street economies, like how exactly can you guarantee that based on, I mean, do you have, you know, essentially data on spending patterns by comparison to like the wild accessibility of highly consolidated retailers like Walmart and Amazon that, you know, people don't have money to spend on healthcare, but they do have smartphones and like they do have the ability to buy shit from e-commerce. So, I mean, like just instantiate for me a little bit this idea that the freedom dividend will like very verifiably go into Main Street economies.
Yeah, so if you look at what Americans are spending their money on right now, it's still like the big ticket items. So it's housing, education, healthcare are like the big ticket items that are also unfortunately going way, way up in price and making Americans very sad and miserable. If you look at the total dollar amount that's going to a company like Netflix or Amazon, it's still relatively trivial in the scheme of the household budget. And so most of the money is going to go towards consumer staples. Now, some of those consumer staples are 100% going to get bought through Amazon and Walmart. So I'm not suggesting that like all the money is out, because some of that money is definitely going to go to the big guys. But a lot of it's also going to go towards services that are really tough to automate to that level, like tutoring and car repairs and like hairdressing and like the, you know, the rest of it that takes place locally.
Right there.
So my first question is not my real question, but do you swear this much in the Bible Belt, or is it just in the audience like this? Because I love it, but personally speaking.
That's a good question, man. I try and refrain from profanity in certain areas. But when I feel like I'm among friends or my tribe, I tend to act more like naturally, which includes like at least some modicum of swearing if I, you know, feel the urge to sort of evince some degree of like enthusiasm.
Yeah. Good answer.
There's no swearing, for example, in my speech to the Iowans.
Yeah.
It's pretty clean cut.
I see that you're positioning yourself as an anti-Donald Trump, which I think makes a lot of sense in this political environment. But I went on your website for the first time today, and I believe it was either the first sentence on about me or your political platform page was essentially like a list of your fears for America. And I think that, you know, our current administration is really playing up on fear as a central tenet to drive people to the polls. And if you're trying to position yourself as the opposite of that, how do you reconcile having to have a fact-based, rational list of eventualities, which are inherently scary, with not running a fear-based campaign?
Yeah, so one thing I think Donald Trump did do very correctly is that he diagnosed that there are certain problems and that certain people are really angry and despair-ridden. What I think is the opposite is that his solutions are like, we're going to freeze time, we're going to turn the clock backwards, we're going to build a wall, it's like the immigrants' fault. Like, all of that stuff is garbage and nonsense and very destructive. So I'm the opposite in terms of the response. But I actually agree with him in terms of diagnosis of the problems. There are really massive problems in, for example, our labor market, where, you know, our labor force participation rate is the same levels as El Salvador and the Dominican Republic, and our headline unemployment rate really is like government malpractice at this point. Now, Donald Trump was saying that during 2016, and then as soon as he became president, he just forgot about it. So, like, his diagnosis was essentially correct. He's just, his responses are all the opposite of what I would do.
So you heard it here first. Andrew Yang has a path to victory, and it all starts in Iowa. We hope you found this talk as interesting as our members did. We're always trying to connect the dots and bring in people that are operating at this interesting intersection of technology and culture. Andrew will be coming back to studios soon, but until then, we'll be keeping tabs on his audacious attempts to fix the future. In the meantime, check out some of our other episodes of Builders. If politics is your thing, we got really real with ex-Senator Bob Kerrey.
Do you think that Donald Trump has a Twitter problem?
No. Twitter's a... No. Be like, if you play the piano loud in a terrible way, I wouldn't say he's got a piano problem. No, no, it's a... No, I think his problem's up here. You know, it, whatever the means of communicating to people, it's... I just think he's a bad guy.
And if the future of technology is your thing, take a listen to what Jaron Lanier has to say about social media and how it's affecting us.
It's mankind has real problems to face.
Yeah.
And if we can't face them with collective sanity, we will die. So I view this as an existential issue.
All of this, along with episodes about building for blockchain, building live experiences for Instagram, and what the industry's best CMOs really think about influencer marketing, can all be found at betaworks-studios.com/stories or on iTunes. Just search for Builders. If you'd like to spend some time with us, check out our membership details at betaworks-studios.com. As we grow the Builder community, we'll still be holding many public events, but the best stuff tends to happen during the day at Betaworks Studios between the members, all sharing ideas and making stuff happen. If you'd like a day pass, just let me know. I can be found on Twitter at Layla Oweda. But also feel free to just click on the description box for other ways to reach me. Check back with us every Tuesday for new episodes. And if you leave us a review in iTunes, that would help so many more people find all of this great knowledge. Follow along with us on social media. We can be found on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at BuildersPod, #BuildersPodcast for all things builders. If you click on the description box, it's all linked there. We look forward to hearing from you. And until next time, I'm Layla Ueda. Happy building from all of us at the BetaWorks Studios team.